Welcome to This Is Not About Your Body, a body neutrality podcast where we talk about all the real shit body image issues are actually about because they're never just about the way you look. I'm your host, Jesse Nealand, and today I have with me Mel Cassidy, who is a mixed race relationship coach and sex positive nerd who works with queer and questioning people and those who love them who are exploring and practicing honest, open relationships. A proud member of the LGBTQIA+ community and co-founder of the Solo Polyamory Facebook group, Mel's been sharing and teaching about non-monogamy for over a decade and is the creator of the Monogamy Detox course, which is a very cool title, I think. I have so much respect for the way Mel approaches the topic of non-monogamy because it can be a very polarizing, very triggering topic for a lot of folks. And I find the way that they bring a lot of groundedness and nuance and compassion to it awesome. And it's very aligned. Their framework for understanding relationships in this space is super trauma-informed and inclusive and somatically integrated. So I wanted to have them on here to explore the topic of non-monogamy as a tool for liberation, healing, and self-connection. So thank you for being here. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you so much for having me, Jesse.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to start by making sure everybody's on the sort of same page about some of the terms we'll be using. And I know that a lot of my listeners probably are not involved in anything in this space or haven't come across it personally. So I'd love to have you start us off with a basic definition of monogamy and a basic definition of non-monogamy.
Awesome. So I always love starting with let's define what we're talking about with monogamy, because there are also many different definitions of monogamy out there. So monogamy at its core is a lifelong exclusive pair bond. Right. And we see this in nature. There are some examples of animals in nature that will form lifelong exclusive pair bonds, or at least more or less exclusive or more or less lifelong. Sure. And as human beings, we are similar. We have culturally gravitated towards looking for exclusive lifetime bonds, but that isn't the right fit for everybody. And that's not how all cultures around the earth have practiced relating. And so non-monogamy is basically anything other than lifetime exclusive pair bonding.
Right.
So it could be that it's only temporary. Maybe, you know, you've had an experience of serial monogamy in your life where you haven't looked at it as lifelong. It's like, I'm going to be with this person exclusively for a while and then with another person exclusively for a while. There's also non-exclusive relationships. So maybe some people have had that experience when they're younger of like, oh, I'm just kind of dating around until I find the one. Right. And I think that's a form of non-monogamy that people may not even think of as non-monogamy, but that there's a sort of cultural acceptance around a level of that. And sometimes that could go into like, oh, maybe they're just playing the field or they're sleeping around.
Yeah.
And that is a form of non-monogamy. And the idea that we only have to be bonded with one other person, you know, that we don't actually, and in reality, as human beings, we bond with multiple people. You know, I could go down a whole rabbit hole around attachment theory here, which I won't do right now, at least. But, you know, human beings, we evolved within village, within community, within an extended network of human beings who we would interact with on a regular basis. And so, you know, we would naturally bond with many people. And so, you know, as human beings today, we have our best friends. We may have besties that we've known since we were kids, or we may have besties that we met last year. And we still form multiple bonds. They may not be romantic bonds. They may not be sexual relationships, but we certainly have the capability of doing that. And so when, you know, and I like to give all of this as an introduction to what non-monogamy is, because I like to encourage people to think outside the box. I think what is often presented to us as non-monogamy is, either like hyper-sexualized swingers or like reality TV shows where couples are seeking a third or things like that. Or a sort of overly dramatized version of polygamy, which is a form of non-monogamy right. that's very much rooted in patriarchy. You know, what I work with is not those things. What I work with is consensual and honest non-monogamy. So that's non-monogamy that's coming from a more feminist framework, from a perspective of how do we liberate ourselves from the confines of pair bonds and how do we explore beyond that? Yeah. And so that can include polyamory. That can include relationship anarchy. That might include, for some people, swinging. It might include a lot of other ways of exploring non-monogamy. But sure. the form for me is about, are you being honest? Are you being transparent? And is there consent? Have people had the opportunity to consent to this? So it's not cheating.
Right.
You're not just, oh, I'm polyamorous, but my wife just doesn't know yet.
Right.
Which I've seen on dating profiles.
Oh my.
And I've come across in the real world as well sometimes, but it's really about how are we cultivating that transparency? Because through that transparency, what we're actually doing is creating community. We're creating yeah. networks of support. We're creating attachment networks and a wider field of bonds. And some of those may be really deep bonds. Some of those may be more superficial connections. But we are cultivating connections in a very conscious and active way.
Yes, I love all of that. I definitely think that we have an over-sexualized version in the mainstream as an idea of what anything other than monogamy looks like. And also just a super, you know, it's like when you've come from diet culture and you're like, well, how am I supposed to know how to eat if I'm not following all of these rules? It's like, how am I supposed to know how to relationship if I'm not following all of these rules? It gets really confusing to people who are inside that rule system, how anyone knows what's going on. But the answer is like, monogamy is pretty prescriptive mm-hmm. and non-monogamy is literally everything else that could possibly exist. It's exactly. actually quite interesting and creative. It doesn't have a look or a structure necessarily.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, that is overwhelming. Right.
Absolutely. You
know, we get a lot of at least a sense of safety and security from being in that prescriptive monogamy mold. We yeah. talk about this model called the relationship escalator, which, you know, is that very familiar. Oh, I'm going to meet this person. I'm going to fall in love with them. We're going to move in together. We'll get married. We'll have babies. We'll get a white house and a picket fence and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Like all that inevitable trajectory. And we all, yeah. you know, there's variations along a theme there. And there's a lot of shame if you step off that escalator or fall yeah. off of it and get divorced or separated. And I think it's very overwhelming when all you know is that escalator to yeah. consider, oh, you mean there's other possibilities? What does that look like? Yeah. And within that overwhelm, sometimes there's a lot of joy. You know, there's like, oh, I found this new playground. And there's totally. All these cool places to go in this adventure and try this and try that. And I think for a lot of people, when they start exploring non-monogamy, there can be this feeling of being like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
Of like, I can try all the things. I want to have this. And I want to have this. And I want to have yeah. this, which is super exciting. And I think can be really nourishing to give yourself permission to explore. And yeah. especially, you know, our culture has this weird relationship to sexuality where it's like, we're going to simultaneously tell you that sex is something to be ashamed of and that you have to be a sexual being.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so we all kind of have a different relationship to that dichotomy. And I think for a lot of people, when they start exploring non-monogamy, it is also having permission to reimagine what their relationship is to that, to Absolutely. Their sexuality and to how they show up as a sexual being in the world.
Yeah. Which, as you said, can be overwhelming and not even always necessarily appealing. which is one of many reasons that it's not the journey for everybody. It feels to me so similar to like the intuitive eating journey when you leave diet culture and you're like, oh my God, what do normal people do? How do they decide what to eat and when and how much? Like, everybody's different. There are no rules here. And to be perfectly honest, some people do better with structure and rules, and that's okay.
Yeah.
There's nothing, yeah. There's no judgment. And I think that's something that it gets really misunderstood. Personally, anytime I mention to people that my partner and I are non-monogamous, I feel like I tend to get, people get uncomfortable or defensive, almost like I'm telling them that monogamy is wrong or bad, or like challenging their choice, which like could not be further from the truth. I'm literally just sharing a fact about me. And I think monogamy is a super valid choice because it takes an absolute shit ton of work to be non-monogamous, and it is not for everybody. If you don't have the bandwidth or the calling or the interest, my God, don't do it. But it definitely is always interesting to me that the perception is like that if you're non-monogamous, you're trying to take down monogamy as if it were that binary. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, people feel threatened by it. Like people who are very much, my monogamy is my foundation, is my security. It can feel threatening to see someone doing something different. Sometimes people might feel threatened because they're like, oh, I didn't even realize that was an option. Oh, crap. Do I have to go rethink things in my life now? Sometimes it can, as you said, feel like, are you trying to challenge my monogamy? Are you telling me that I'm wrong? And I think that when we are embarking on that journey of non-monogamy, we are in some ways challenging monogamy in ourselves, right? We are working on undoing the monogamous assumptions that we have just accepted through the years. Yeah. We're working on undoing all the unhealthy relationship tropes that come along with monogamy.
Yeah.
You know, and I, some of those are culturally enforced. You know, I think about how like so many sitcoms will play into this, like, oh, when a couple has an argument, it becomes one versus the other and who's going to win. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is very much like, how do you have power over your partner? Which I see as coming from that like patriarchal root of things. And when we are challenging that, it's like, well, then what does an argument become? Oh, what if we are actually on the same team together, and what we are combating is the monogamous upbringing that was not the right fit for us. Absolutely. And we're both bumping into that at the same time in different ways. So how do we work through that together?
Do you know what I have personally found to be one of the most interesting. I mean, I just find the topic so interesting. The work is worth it to me because it's a fascinating area for growth. And my goal in life is to think interesting thoughts. So this suits me. However, one of the things that it never occurred to me ever before I came across non-monogamous content and ideas was like, how do we know we're loved? In monogamy, you know you're loved because they're not sleeping with anybody else. They've picked you. We each pick one. You get one. You pick them. And that's how you know. Also, by the way, that doesn't make most people feel particularly loved. After a certain point, being picked is a shitty way of loving someone. It's like a default, boring, not especially nourishing way of saying I love you. So like when you take that out of the picture, everyone has to be a lot more creative and realistic about literally, how would I like to be loved? Mm-hmm. How would I like to feel special to you if it's not through the lens of you picked me and nobody else the end?
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Well, and I think that the fairy tale of monogamy tells us that we're going to live happily ever after once we find that person. So it kind of brings in some of that complacency.
Yeah.
And I think non-monogamy does not allow for complacency. I think the inherent complexity of it does not allow for complacency. You know, in the beginning of a relationship, we form what I call the necessary fantasy of the other person. And there's nothing wrong with having that fantasy, right? And in polyamory, we might call that new relationship energy.
Sure.
And we're all familiar with that, like intoxication and infatuation. And you're like, oh my gosh, they're so amazing. And over time, that fantasy will be replaced by reality. And we, you know, fingers crossed, reality is not too different from the fantasy. And sometimes we're like, oh, they're amazing, but sometimes they chew their food a bit loudly, or their feet smell, or like those little things, but we're able to reconcile that. And then we might come across like bigger incompatibilities that then we have to go, okay, now there's conflict in our relationship. How do we move through that? Yeah. Now in dyadic relationships, so there's only two people involved in the relationship, that stage doesn't usually come until between 2 to 5, maybe even 7 years in, of really kind of bumping up against, this is the reality of the person, not the fantasy that I've had of them.
Huh.
But in non-monogamous relationships, when you've got other partners, whether they're your own partners or your partner's partners,
right,
their presence provides a contrast.
Mm.
And that contrast can sometimes poke at the fantasy.
Right.
And so we might start to enter that phase of challenging the fantasy much earlier.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So sometimes it can feel a little unsettling because we go, but I'm in love and I should feel great and it should just be able to be this way forever.
Yeah.
And we're actually like, oh, I'm bumping up against an incompatibility. I'm bumping up against seeing that my fantasy may be different from the reality. And maybe I need a bit more time to adjust to that. Or maybe that's an indicator for me to not be complacent.
Yeah.
To not just sit back and go, we know we love each other. Maybe that's an opportunity for me to be more engaged.
Yes.
And present. And then how do I work on the capacity as an individual to be more present with all these different partners and all these different dynamics? Because I think that that question of capacity to show up is the one that a lot of people skip over in non-monogamy. Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, it's fine to say I want all the partners, but do you actually have the time?
Right.
Do you have the emotional bandwidth?
I feel like that was my big first big insight was like I had always thought I wanted like a boyfriend and a girlfriend like in my ideal. And then I was like, I'm so tired. I can't do this. It's so much work to like hold all of the relationship conversations and even just the feelings in your body. It's so much. So this basically is one of the most, I think, potentially liberating aspects of exploring a non-monogamous lens, even if the actions don't necessarily end up going very far at all. I mean, you could be playing in a fantastical space with your partner, but like there is something about what we think of as security that is actually just like anxiety avoidance. And, you know, you're like, oh, I feel secure because they're not going to do anything that scares me too much because that's our agreement. However, it is being scared sometimes that makes us like step up a little bit and be like, whoa, how do I make sure my partner's needs are being met and that they feel loved and cared for and safe, or that mine are,
mm-hmm.
when you haven't agreed to just avoid everything scary,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have those real conversations.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we, particularly in more like Western culture, we tend to think of those kinds of emotions as bad, right? If I feel right. scared, if I feel jealous, if I feel insecure, that is somehow a personal failing in me.
Right.
And I 100% agree with you that when we have those emotions come up, what if that's actually an opportunity? What if there is a way to engage with that and learn yeah. from that? You know, in my somatic experiencing work, I look at how we might move into self-protection. So let's say I'm feeling insecure about something that my partner is doing. I might feel myself going into a bit of a flight response and recoiling away and maybe being more distant. And what if that's actually okay to listen to that?
Yeah.
Maybe the strategy and the way that I'm doing the distancing isn't supportive to the relationship, but what if it's okay to honor, hey, there's a part of me right now that's recoiling.
Yeah.
There's a part of me right now that feels anxious. Maybe I don't understand it yet, but what if I can acknowledge that there's fear coming up from me? Oh, yeah. What's that fear about? What is it that I'm afraid of losing? Did I know that I had that? Did I know that that thing was actually so important to me?
Yeah.
Does my partner know that this relationship provides me with that?
Right.
Right. So
I feel like such a good example of, by the way, for anybody who's listening and hasn't explored this, I assure you, you can learn so many shocking things about yourself that, like, we all invent a story about ourselves and we're pretty sure we're right about it. And then non-monogamy will challenge some of that shit in the most humbling of ways. But I was going to say, I feel like there have been moments of realizing, like, I'm super confident, super secure. Mm-hmm. I'm very proud of myself for this, right? I like that about me. I'm a bit attached to that. So when something gets hit and I'm like, okay, well, here's jealousy or insecurity or shame or like some random thing that I discover. Well, I don't care about any number of aspects of somebody my partner's interested in unless she's funnier than me. Then I'm going to have a problem. You know what I mean? Like, these are things you learn and you're like, whoa. Had it not been for the fact that we're having open conversations, I could have just ignored all of that and never known these things about myself.
Yeah.
And each one is an invitation.
It is. And I remember very early on in my own non-monogamy journey thinking to myself, this is like the best self-development workshop. And, you know, I know plenty of people who've explored non-monogamy as a part of their journey. It hasn't been their final destination in their relationship journey, but it's been a chapter in that journey. And they have done it to learn those skills, yeah. Or at least they've learned those skills and benefited from the learning of those skills, and then gone into monogamy in a much more conscious way. Or maybe the way that they were doing non-monogamy shifted.
Mm-hmm.
From what they originally thought it was. I mean, I know for myself, it shifted.
Absolutely. It's constantly shifting. Because you can't know until you start trying and walking that path a little bit. And you're like, oh, not that, but this.
You really don't know. And going back to that idea of like the escalator versus an open landscape of possibilities, you really are kind of going in as an explorer, as an adventurer, going, what will I find over here? Do I like what I find over here? Is this the place that I want to stay? Do I want to go explore what's over on that other side? Oh, that person looks like they're having fun. What are they doing? Right. Oh, that person did not have fun. Maybe I want to avoid that place only to realize like, oh, it just wasn't the right place for them to be. And, you know, we are doing that exploring. And I think with that exploring comes an openness and a curiosity. And that naturally allows us to see more of ourselves. It's just like, you know, a lot of people find when they go traveling, they learn more about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
We put ourselves in a different environment and we go, oh, I didn't know I could do this. Yeah. I don't know I would react this way. And I think in the same way, non-monogamy, you're holding up more mirrors for yourself.
Oh, yes.
You have people reflecting back, oh, actually, that is a me thing. All these years I've been blaming my partners. Actually, it turns out it's me. Oh, now what do I do with that? And I think in that, I mean, the people that I work with, I see a lot of people exploring non-monogamy and coming to a place of really deep healing in themselves.
Yeah.
You know, when what I call the shadow emotions like jealousy and fear and anger and envy show up, they are often tied to, you know, some of the really deep traumas that we've had in our lives around disconnection, around abandonment, around not feeling loved or not feeling like we're good enough. And, you know, the presence of non-monogamy can be a catalyst for working on those things. And as we work on those things, we're not just doing that to grow more capacity for non-monogamy. What we're actually doing is growing more capacity to be ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like such a great example of what that can look like. You mentioned fear of abandonment. It's the idea that like people imagine that partnering in this monogamous way where you've been chosen, you chose each other, everything is like, you know, very structured, that you'll never be abandoned. And of course, most people can feel afraid of the abandonment anyway, because you're basically just trusting someone to like not only not cheat on you or whatever, but like not die. You know, it's like you're hoping your heart doesn't get broken.
Yeah.
But there's also this much deeper thing that can't be healed inside of that, which is like, the fact that sometimes you are literally abandoned by someone who is still living in your house and saying, I love you when they come home. Like, yeah. Abandonment is this much more complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's your wound, it cannot and will not be healed if you're assuming that the healing, that the only medicine available is being chosen.
Yeah. I think sometimes those things are like a Band-Aid, right?
Yeah.
We think this will be good enough. This is what I can rely on. I have a ring on my finger. We have this marriage certificate. We own a home together, whatever, whatever. And we think that that offers us the security. And I think it's really important to separate the form from the feeling.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We can get very attached to the form of things because we live in a very materialistic world. We live in a world that's very much about our productivity and about what we have. And, you know, we look at those accolades and there's a lot of celebration that happens when you're on that relationship escalator and moving in with somebody or having kids and so forth. But to actually focus on what is the feeling that I'm having? What is the experience for me in this relationship? Do I feel like there is space for me? Do I feel like I am liberated in this? Do I feel like I can be expressive and discover myself? Or do I feel like I have to hold a part of myself back? Do I feel like I have to compartmentalize pieces of myself? And that may not be a reflection on how your partner treats you. That may be a reflection on the circumstances in life, the traumas that you're holding, the systemic oppression that you navigate, right? So many different pieces can be involved in that. But I think ultimately I hope to invite people into curiosity about is, how am I feeling in this? Does the form support me to feel free to explore myself?
Yeah.
Does this form support me in feeling safe enough to take risks? Does this form support me in being transparent and honest with the people I love and care about?
Yeah. You know, I think what you said before about the somatic experiencing and the self-validation that comes in being like, hey, I'm going into a fight or flight response right now. Maybe that's valid. Let me hold that really gently and explore it with curiosity instead of just shutting it down. So much of monogamous expectations, I think, are like self-gaslighting. Sometimes we gaslight each other, but a lot of it is us gaslighting ourselves.
Yeah.
For example, like the idea that you're not attracted to anyone else and never can be or should be again because you've picked someone and they won't either. Otherwise, something is wrong. Like, that's obviously some major gaslighting. But even on that deeper level of like, if your partner is insecure and you get frustrated and go like, why would you be insecure? I say I love you. Like, you should know this, right? Like, there is so much, even if they're not saying these things, we'll say it to ourselves. I shouldn't be feeling a fight or flight response. I shouldn't be feeling insecure or jealous. None of this is valid because I can't point to something in the world that proves it, makes it sound valid. A lot of the liberating work of non-monogamy, which doesn't even have to do with the non-monogamy at this point, like we're like deep in the weeds here, but it really is about saying, I believe me.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to look at that and I'm willing to be honest about that. And I'm choosing partners who are willing to do the same.
Yeah. And I know that in my own relational journey, I was definitely in that position of being in a monogamous relationship, gaslighting myself around my attraction and the impulses and the feelings and all the emotions I was having. And it was stepping into the, you know, owning it to myself of like, no, I need to be true to myself. I need to own this.
Yeah.
That began that journey of coming back to myself, reclaiming myself in terms of like, I actually have permission to feel what I'm feeling. I don't need to squash that for anybody. I shouldn't need to be pretzeling myself for the sake of security or stability, because what is the cost to me?
Or they're just, even the expectation of someone who's partnered with you a long time thinks they know you better than you know yourself, kind of thing. There's pressure in that too, even when it's never coming from a malevolent or oppressive place, it can end up feeling the same.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Also, so much of monogamy coming from patriarchal structures, et cetera, has to do with ownership, right? So there is also just something innately liberating, I think, about stepping away from a structure, or at least getting much more curious and creative when you think about the structure that began in ownership and still often ends in ownership, not the same way legally now, but like we feel entitled to each other in monogamy in a way that is very ownershipy. And I'm sometimes like, I watch my body have reactions and I'm like, my body is doing a very primal thing right now where it wants to own you. And like, I can watch that happen. I don't agree with it on a conscious level, but there's deep stuff in that, right? Like,
yeah.
Like you're mine, you know, like it happens. It's real. So it's not like the goal is to never feel those ways or never have that stuff come up, but to be much more thoughtful about what we do with that information.
Yeah. And I think that there's a part of that energy around possession or entitlement that we can channel into play. That we can channel into, maybe that's part of your kink dynamic.
Exactly.
Or maybe that's part of the way that you banter, but to not take it too seriously, you know, to not let that feeling, that impulse create meaning.
I love that. I don't know how much you know about my work, but body neutrality, it's about like stripping away the meaning from bodies. That is so in alignment. I love that.
Well, no wonder we're in alignment then.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's so much that we couple up together and think, oh, this thing happened, so it must mean this. Oh, I have great sex with this person. They must be my soulmate. Mm-hmm. And then we get, you know, get into a lifelong partnership with that person. And we're like, well, the sex isn't so good anymore, but it should be because they're my soulmate. Right. And we had that great sex 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And we start like doing those internal brain gymnastics trying to justify it. And it's like, what if we just drop the meaning? Mm-hmm. What if we allow things to just be what they are? Right now I'm experiencing a great connection. Right now I'm experiencing a desire to like be with you forever. Right now I'm experiencing a desire to be far away from you. And then once we can own that, we can explore, okay, well, what do we do with that?
Right.
But that
God, it's such a thing though, in like culturally, part of the gaslighting is just that we are expected to be these stable, non-evolving people.
Yeah.
Like, well, I felt this way once and we agreed to a thing based on it, and that's how I'm supposed to feel forever, and anything else is a problem.
Yeah. And I mean, I think back to, you know, in pre-Christian traditions, the hand fasting that would be done in a lot of like Celtic Europe. So in hand fasting, the tradition was you would start off making that commitment for a year and a day, and then you would decide if you wanted to renew it.
Like a marriage, basically?
Like a marriage, but not.
Oh, interesting.
Like,
I haven't heard of that.
It's like a temporary marriage. Like,
okay.
Like kind of
I
like
love
an
that.
Engagement, but with a time frame. And I think there's many different variations. And you look at other cultures, and there's many different ways to be able to go, I'm not into this anymore. I mean, in Islamic law, a woman can say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and that's it. Technically, they're divorced. And so, you know, I think that having that permission for fluidity, having that permission for change, I think that's something that is innate to us as human beings.
Yeah.
And that, you know, through the history, there are different ways that we try to explore that. There's also different ways that that can feel very scary. And, we try to lock things in, going, marriage is for life. And I mean, there's a whole thing about sexual fidelity and being a way to control STIs before we had medicine and barriers and safer sex practices and so forth. But, or at least the knowledge, widespread knowledge of safer sex practices. But I think, having that permission for fluidity, you know, that brings us into the realm of relationship anarchy, which a lot of people, I think, misunderstand.
Can you give us a definition of it?
So anarchy is not the same as chaos. Anarchy comes from the Greek anarchos, without rule. So anarchy is saying, I'm not accepting the status quo. I'm not accepting to be governed by rules that have been imposed on me by other people who are not me.
Mm.
So relationship anarchy is about applying that into our relationships. Now, I should also say it's not the same as relationship libertarianism. It's not saying...
I haven't even heard of that one.
It's not saying, I'm just going to fend for myself. You do you, I'll do me. Because part of the philosophy of anarchy, if I'm not accepting imposed rule from someone else, what I have to do for survival is I have to create cooperative networks. I have to create community. I have to engage in community. I have to build consensus. I have to work collaboratively with other people for our shared benefit.
Ooh, right.
And so in relationship anarchy, what we're actually exploring is how do we work collaboratively on an intimate scale?
Yeah.
How do we build our relationships in such a way that both give us the level of security and structure and support that we each need as individuals, and simultaneously do not confine us or restrict us, so that we can feel the space to have that freedom of expression, to have that freedom of exploration, to have that freedom to change if things are not feeling the same anymore, to change the structure and form, to not be limited in that, and to lead with the feeling.
You know, when you put it like that, it just seems so simple.
It's so obvious. Why aren't we all doing this?
Why aren't we all doing it? Okay, so that leads me to the question of solo polyamory, which I know is something that you talk about a lot, and I'd love to have you give a definition. Because obviously there's lots of different structures. The structures are, I think, shorthand. Mm-hmm. Just like in the queer community and in the gender, you know, evolution right now, we're all just making some words up to so we can try to make ourselves clear to other people. The words and the language and the concepts are all evolving. But there are different structures that some people really identify with or might move through different phases of inside of non-monogamy.
Yeah.
Solo polyamory being one of them. So could you give us a definition of that?
Yeah. So solo polyamory is consensual non-monogamy without the desire to be on the relationship escalator.
Mm. Okay.
So what that can look like is many different things. But to give you a little bit of history to it, 13 years ago now, when I started exploring non-monogamy, everything that I came across was from the perspective of you are either like part of a throuple or like group relationship, or you are part of a primary couple who are looking for a third, or mm-hmm. who are looking to date someone who's secondary.
Yeah.
And for me, coming out of a long-term monogamous marriage, I was like, none of those feel appealing to me. I would like to be my own primary partner. Thank you very much. And so that's how I started describing myself. I'm like, I am my own primary partner. I'm having an orgy with the universe, but at the end of the day, it comes back to me.
So
around the same time, so I started writing a blog about my experiences, and around the same time there was another writer who started writing a blog about her experiences and in doing solo polyamory. And I think us connecting and starting that Facebook group and bringing in other people has really helped flesh out what are people experiencing solo polyamory to be.
Yeah.
So, there is some gatekeeping, and I've definitely been guilty of the gatekeeping in the past, but I've come to a different relationship with that. I think, ultimately what people who are practicing solo polyamory have in common is we have a desire to not get enmeshed or coupled up in that escalator way. Most of the time, we're not looking to live with a partner. We're not looking to cohabitate with a partner. Or co-parent with them necessarily. Sometimes that does happen. And I think, the economic reality that many of us are in, certainly the way things shifted during the pandemic, a lot of people moved into temporary cohabitating agreements. And then we're like, am I still solo polyamorous? Is this still a way I can describe myself? And that's where I think it's really important to look at the difference between descriptive versus prescriptive. For me, solo polyamory is descriptive. Mm-hmm. I think in the past, I may have said it was prescriptive for me, but I think now it's descriptive of how I live my life. I am still my own primary partner. I don't want to live with any partners. Right. If a partner stayed over more than 3 nights in a row, I would kick them out. I feel like I need some space here. Why are you? Don't you have a home? Don't you have somewhere else to go? But And even when I've had long distance partners visit, we navigate, okay, how do we do this in a way that neither of us are going to get frustrated with each other? But within solo polyamory, there's definitely a lot of celebration of that agency and relational autonomy. But there's also some people who misunderstand it as being like, again, that you're being completely individualistic, that solo polyamorists are just players or not interested in commitment. And, right. and I would say that is the furthest thing from the truth. You know, people in the solo polyamorous world are very much interested in building lifelong relationships, long-lasting relationships. Maybe the shape of that changes. Maybe who, you know, the way that you describe that relationship changes. There are a number of people who've started that journey in a marriage and gone, I don't actually want to be married to this person or common law with this person anymore. They don't want that either. We just got married because we thought that's what we were supposed right, to do yeah. as grownups. And so they go through a process of conscious uncoupling, maybe separating, moving out, and maybe they're still in each other's lives. Yeah. Maybe they're still sexual partners or romantic partners. Maybe they're not. But they get to yeah. have that freedom to reimagine the relationship. So some people are doing solo polyamory in that way. Yeah.
I love the idea that it's descriptive instead of prescriptive. I will say that your definition is much broader and more fluid than any that I've heard, but it also makes so much perfect sense that this is what you would give. And it feels like it lands like so beautifully to me. Because, yeah, I've probably mostly come across more of a prescriptive model, like this is what it looks like, which is, as we just sort of said, not necessarily valuable to most people in most situations. I have often thought of it as like you say, partnered with yourself, right? You're your own primary partner. So for people who aren't in this world, there is a hierarchy mm-hmm. often built into non-monogamy for people who have a primary partner, which might be like your spouse, your, you know, long-term committed partner, whatever it is, the person you are most committed to mm-hmm. and usually see the most and, you know, whatever, have the most obligations with, whatever it is. And then you've got a secondary partner and maybe a tertiary partner. And obviously nobody's following exactly this kind of structure, but there is a sense that you kind of have your one person who's like above everybody else, mm-hmm. which inherently creates some very weird power dynamics with everybody else. It can, in fact, be very damaging and even abusive, I think, because it fundamentally disrespects people's humanity when they haven't been put on this pedestal. But what I've always thought of solo poly is that the hierarchy is you.
Yeah.
Like it's you and everyone else is, there is no hierarchy to anyone else, mm-hmm. but you are the hierarchy, right? Like you are. Mm-hmm. And I love that you say that primary partner thing because it's exactly that. Your loyalty, your commitment, your obligation is to yourself first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And so many things can fit inside of that beautifully, but it's going to be naturally a lot more fluid and more evolving than if you have chosen someone to sit on that pedestal with you.
Yeah. And I will say that there are also a lot of people in the solo polyamory world who would say that they don't use the description of being in a primary relationship with themselves because of the implied hierarchy.
Oh, and... Of course. I just said it. Of course, that makes so much sense.
And I think it's really interesting. And yeah, like the hierarchy, I call what you described there with the primary and secondary, I call that the polynormative model of relating, you know, because sure, that's what the media tends to kind of gravitate towards whenever there's surveys or questionnaires. That's what they assume. They're like, are you in a polyamorous relationship? And I'm like, well, how many are you talking about?
Right. And yeah, that's so true.
They have the assumption that you're already part of a couple.
It just shows how hard it is to step outside this box. Even people who are like asking poly people about their experiences are like, they can't even see that the question is innately. Yeah, no.
When I'm talking to journalists, sometimes I feel like I have to like, here's the glossary, here's the sensitivity right. reading before we go into the question. But going back to the hierarchy piece, you know, I think that the model of an egalitarian relationship where everyone is treated as equal, where there isn't any kind of like, oh, I'm choosing you over somebody else, right? The hierarchical model that feels oppressive is when we have power over. And so in that model, my primary partner might be able to veto my other girlfriend or might be able right. to control what I'm able to do with that other partner over here. So that is power over, and that would definitely feel oppressive. Having
and
said
by the
that,
way, anybody who's out there and their male partner is like, well, you can hook up with women, but just not with dudes. This is veto power and it's inappropriate. And it is a very weird, unhealthy, kind of creepy power dynamic situation fraught with all kinds of oppressive issues. Anyway, carry on.
I could talk for an hour just about that. But, you know, there's also a way of doing hierarchy that isn't oppressive. And there's a way of doing egalitarian relationships that may also feel oppressive, right? Because sometimes what we need is not compatible with everybody being treated equally, everybody being treated exactly the same in a relationship. Sure. You know, there are examples in the history of non-monogamy in the 20th and 21st centuries where we can see people really trying hard to create a system that is egalitarian, where everybody is treated equally, mm-hmm. and doing so at the detriment of the authenticity.
Sure.
So there's an example, the Carista commune, they coined the word compersion, which is the opposite of jealousy, sympathetic joy. And the Carista commune, very heteronormative. They were in group relationships, but the women had their own bedrooms, and the men had to rotate through the different bedrooms every night. So like, you wouldn't sleep with the same partner two nights in a row. You'd be on a sleeping schedule.
Whoa.
So it was a kind of enforced egalitarian. And I'm like, I get where they were coming from. Like, I can see where the reasoning behind that was. But what a lot of people who were in that have reported, and you can Google, you can find their journals and essays. They said that it really felt oppressive for them.
I bet. My skin crawled when you said it, like that you just have to basically spend that intimate time and space with people that is not feeling like what you're wanting.
And, you know, my own experience in relationships is I've been in egalitarian relationships that have felt oppressive, that have felt like there's a forcing this thing to be something that it's not. Mm-hmm. And I've also been in egalitarian relationships that have felt really good and that there's lots of freedom. And I've been in hierarchical relationships that have felt very oppressive and a lot of like, my humanity is not being honored. My needs are not being heard here. And I've been in hierarchical relationships where, like, not on that top row, where I'm like, this is great. This is actually all I need. I don't need more than this in this connection. I am actually only here for the recreational aspect of it and have no illusions that there's going to be anything more because you've communicated that your capacity very clearly to me. Right. So I think you're right. I know I'm turning everything on its head. And there's a lot of kind of debate back and forth in non-monogamy spaces about hierarchy, egalitarian, good, bad. Yeah. And I think sometimes we get a bit like Animal Farm about it, like four legs good, two legs bad, and back and forth. And I think what it really comes down to for me is it feeling oppressive or is it feeling liberatory? Because what feels oppressive for one person may not feel that way for another person. And what feels liberating may change. Yeah. You may be in a connection where you're like, this is everything I have ever wanted. This is exactly how I want things to be. And then you change. Your needs change. We change as we grow older. We might acquire a disability. We might change the way that we need to live our lives. Our schedule may be different. Our health may be different. And so the ways that we engage in our relationships may necessarily need to shift as well. Yeah. And so I think what's really, really important, whether monogamous or non-monogamous or anything in between, is to really hold that consideration consciously and mindfully of, how is this supporting me?
Yeah.
Is this supporting me? What could I move towards to feel more supported?
It feels like it goes right back to the idea that we love structure and we love rules. And so we're like, we're going to liberate ourselves from this structure and these rules. And in order to do that, we're going to come up with some new structures and new rules. And that'll be how we free ourselves. But yeah, I mean, that makes a ton of sense.
And I think that is a lot of the lacking nuances, people choosing one or the other and being like, this is the way to do it. This is the better way to do it. And ultimately, like, everybody's different. Everybody's constantly evolving. And the question even of, am I feeling expansive inside of this versus restricted inside of this, could change dramatically over the course of time with different people, different, all kinds of things. I had a client once who, when she was raising, they had little kids. She was raising the little kids and she was like, I don't need or want to be sexual with literally anybody, including you, sir. Like, that's not what I'm about right now. So he wanted to experience a little bit more like sexual freedom. He had that on his side. She had a close emotional bond with a friend who he'd always been jealous of. This was like they opened it up in this unequal but equal way, right? It was incredible. It worked for them so well. As her kids got older, her sex drive came back and she was like, let's restructure, babies. Like, we got this in a whole new way now. Yeah. And it was so functional. I was always so impressed. Like, yes, everybody got what they wanted, but it wasn't, if they'd had to do the same things to consider it fair, nobody would have gotten what they wanted, first of all.
Yeah.
And second of all, just that understanding, that deeply authentic truth that is, we are always evolving. And so any external structure or rule is eventually going to feel oppressive.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't evolve with us.
I love that example because it really shows the fluidity. And you're right. You know, we lean on structure to give us security. It's that Band-Aid. And I think it's okay to use it as scaffolding, right? It's okay to have structure as scaffolding. If we're going through times of uncertainty, transition, change, trying something new, maybe we need a bit of scaffolding to support us while we get used to that.
Totally.
So I think when people are exploring opening up for the first time or exploring a different way of opening up, I think, great, have some agreements, have some rules, have some guidelines, but don't write them in stone. You know, let's do this as an experiment. Let's go gather information. Okay, we want to open up. We don't know what we actually want. Maybe what we do for the first 3 months is just go to a lot of sex parties.
Yeah.
And just observe and just see how we feel. And then let's debrief about that and go from there. And then how do we want to imagine that next? And so, you know, the structure is there to support the feeling.
Love it. Also, I think just to go back to that veto idea, I think that when you're not in this space, or actually even quite a few people who really are deeply in this space, focus on the rules of non-monogamy as restrictive based, right? So it's like you can do X, Y, Z, just not these other things, or as long as these contexts are met, or these, you know, whatever. And I feel like the super patriarchal problematic example of you can sleep with women, but not men. It's like we focus on what you can't do, which assumes automatically that you haven't really stepped out of the oppressive structure.
Yeah.
Because you're still focused on control and possessiveness and, you know, all of these structures. Like, it can be an improvement for some people for sure, but it's inherently you haven't actually left the world.
Well, and it's a kind of bargaining, right? You're bargaining with the relationship. You're like, I'll let you do the thing, but you cannot do this thing.
Right.
Or people get into the transactionality of it, of like, you can go on a date with your girlfriend if I can go on a date with my boyfriend that night. And bargaining is an aspect of grief. And so whenever I hear someone going into bargaining, I get really curious about, what are you grieving right now?
Oh God, that's so true and heartbreaking and real.
And what we are probably grieving is the fantasy.
Yeah.
That necessary fantasy that we had at the beginning of the relationship
yeah.
that has been fed very often by the expectations of monogamy and the fairy tale and the happily ever after. And now I've demonstrated to the world I'm a successful grown up adult and all of that. We're grieving the loss of that because, you know, if you're going from being coupled into opening up, opening up is the death of that relationship. It is the end of that relationship. It's the beginning of a new expression of the relationship. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the end of the connection, but we experience it somatically as grief.
I've never thought about that actually, and that is so powerful and really rings true in my coaching experience and my personal experience that underneath all of that is grief. I guess I never thought how explicitly that grief is the loss of. I mean, there's so much to grieve. There
So
really
much
is.
again
It's
and again.
yeah, like it makes so much that sense that that's what we would end up doing. And also why I think most people who start that way are more likely to be able to evolve into like a less restrictive sensibility about it, because we've probably moved through the stages of grief as we've gone along and sort of established that it's still safe with our partner and all these things, as opposed to like going from monogamy to non-restricted,
Yeah.
like non-oppressed. That's too much. It's too fast. It's too much. Like that, I think makes a lot of sense, because you literally need that time to grieve alone and with your partner if you're opening it in that way. It just, there's a lot
And
to let go of.
I think the grief comes up as well, even if you're entering this from a solo space, if
Yeah.
you're entering this without partners, there is still the grieving of, oh, I'm not actually looking for that fairy tale anymore. I have to let go of the way that I've attached my own sense of self-importance or
Yes.
vision of success or accomplishment and all these things based on a
Yeah.
partnership. There's a grief around letting go of the codependency patterns that we might hold. There's a grief of going, oh, how have I learned to orient towards partners so much
Yeah.
and never oriented to myself? So there's still a
Totally.
whole other grief process in there. But I always look for those signs of grief of like, okay, is someone bargaining? Is someone getting angry?
Anger, yeah.
Right? Are we falling into that despair? Like, what is happening? And,
Yeah.
going back to the honoring what we feel, can we
Yeah.
give time for that? Can we give space for that? Maybe we need to do something to ritualize that. And how do we then resource ourselves to be able to do that properly with the grief? So, yeah.
Yeah, God, that's beautiful. Also, Mel, I'm realizing that I have not asked you like a single question I had prepared. This is all so interesting, but I did really want to get to this topic of self-partnership. I'm curious if you define self-partnership as different or separate from solo poly, and if so, how? Because I know that's a big part of the work that you do and the content that you put out there.
Yeah, it is separate from solo polyamory because anyone can be self-partnered.
Okay.
I think solo polyamory lends itself really well to self-partnership. And for me, those two journeys are tied together. But self-partnership is really about saying, I'm going to honor myself. I'm going to seek to know and understand myself and love myself as deeply as I might seek to love a romantic partner. And I will show up for myself as much as I might want to show up for a partner or want a partner to show up for me.
Yeah.
So it is a journey of
Ugh.
reclaiming ourselves away from the kind of confines and social straitjackets and everything. And I think a big part of that is, I feel like it's kind of cheesy, but like the loving acceptance of ourselves. Recognizing like this is who I am. These are my strengths. These are the things that I struggle with. These are the things
Yeah.
that I would love to do, right? And really stepping into that, but also celebrating all of those pieces, celebrating our messiness as well as
Ooh.
the things that we're like really proud of. Because in that, what we do through self-partnership is we step into a more authentic space in ourselves. And what then becomes possible is more authentic relationships with others. Right? When we do not have self-partnership, what happens instead is that we are often trying to conform to what people have told us about ourselves or meeting somebody else's expectation or assumption of us. And within that, there's a layer of inauthenticity.
Yep.
And then that inauthenticity will blend into our intimate relationships. And then we go, what the heck is happening? Why is
Yeah.
my partner acting like I'm someone else? Why am I trying to relate to my partner and they're not responding in the way that I thought they would?
Yeah.
So I think for me, self-partnership is, you know, it's the foundational piece of getting real, of getting honest with ourselves about what do I actually need? What do I actually want? Yeah. I may have had all these strategies for getting my needs met that I've learned through life or that other people have offered to me, and maybe they don't actually work for me.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not authentic, you know, to use a food analogy. It's like, well, I know I need nutrients, but maybe all this time I've been eating a food that I had a sensitivity to and I didn't realize it.
Been there.
Same.
Done it.
and like my body has been screaming and telling me, don't eat this thing. And so the self-relationship is about listening to those signals going, oh, I'm actually not feeling great here.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming into this from a somatic and trauma-informed perspective, you know, we tend to get very good at pretending that we're fine. That is one of our great survival strategies in life is,
yeah,
I'm fine. This is fine. We might be that dog in the house
that's burning
down in that cartoon to be like, this is fine. And, you know, I've heard that referred to as like the false window of tolerance, this idea of like, no, I'm totally fine because this is, I can handle this. I can cope with this.
Yeah.
And sure, we can cope with that. But actually, there's a space that's a lot more grounded that we could access. Yeah. And sometimes we've never even touched that before. Sometimes we've been running around in survival mode so much that we don't know what that feels like until we get there.
Oof.
We don't know that we're missing it.
So Gabor Mate's new book, The Myth of Normal, which I think should be required reading for everyone on earth. He talks about the thing that happens in childhood, the trauma that exists inherently when authenticity must be traded for attachment. In an ideal world, authenticity and attachment could coexist, comfy, nice, and, you know, everybody's happy. You are fully yourself. Everyone celebrates and, you know, attaches to you in ways that make you feel safe and secure. That almost never happens. So mostly we've got a bunch of traits happening in our identities and how we show up in our relationships in order to get those attachment needs met, because they're what keep us alive. And yeah, authenticity, although that's also a need for thriving, is on a, it's play second fiddle to not dying.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about how in adulthood, so much of our disease and mental health issues and all of these things that hurt us and keep us from thriving are the result of that pattern, basically trading authenticity for attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that there's a pretty pathologizing view, even in like healing, wellness, and therapy spaces. I see a lot of like pretty hardcore pathologizing that makes you, you know, it's like just not exactly just get over it. It's like get over it, but in therapy speak, you know, like just work on your trauma so that you're not bringing all that baggage to a relationship. But fundamentally, I see this as it is not an easy path. That is by no means what I'm trying to say, but the easiest path to restore authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically by continuing through that mononormative lens and you're just continuously trying to be what they expect or want or need or whatever, or who they see you as, or, you know, all of this stuff, it plays into every pattern that leads to insecurity, body image, yeah, attachment wounding. Like what you're describing through self-partnership is truly just returning, saying both of these I need, but one has been gone a long time.
Yeah.
And I want that one back.
And to tie that back into attachment, what I think is really interesting, because a lot of people have this idea that self-partnership is individualistic. And I say it's not. Self-partnership is an essential component of mutual aid. Self-partnership is an essential component of building networks of secure attachment.
Mm.
Because as you grow closer to your own authenticity, you are going to be better at recognizing, where are the authentic connections for attachment?
Right.
And right. So what you start shifting towards, it's kind of like you're weeding your relationship landscape and going, I thought this plant was going to be great here, but yeah, actually it doesn't belong in my garden.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to shift it, or maybe we need to transplant this plant to part of the garden where it's going to get better nutrients. You know, we shift towards more authenticity in the attachments that we create. so that we no longer have to be in that place of sacrificing.
Yes.
And that doesn't happen overnight. You know, no. I think it's really important to acknowledge we have a very, very vast capacity for tolerance. And sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more, sometimes it depends on what it is we're tolerating and what the payoff for it is. Survival is a really great payoff. But, you know, it's kind of like having a pebble in your shoe. Over time, right. If you're tolerating something that isn't ideal for you, you will blister.
Yeah.
And when we emotionally blister, it becomes really hard to make connection. Yes. So coming back into that connection with ourselves is a way of, okay, I'm going to soothe the places where I have felt emotionally blistered. I'm going to reevaluate how I recognize the safe places to form connections, the safe places to build attachments, the safe places to form networks.
So there's so much in that that is like discernment and capacity and skill for sure, of actually building different connections and more authentic and intimate connections. But there's also like an aspect, I'm completely blanking on the author's name of that book, My Grandmother's Hands.
Resmaa Menakem.
Thank you. Yes. So he talks about like chapter one, he's like, basically I have a job as a therapist because I have a regulated nervous system.
Yeah.
People come to me and they talk. We talk. Sometimes it's good talk, but mostly the healing happens because they spend an hour a week with somebody who's regulated in such a deeply embodied way that they leave more regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that aspect too of like when you are in this deeply connected to self place, you are more regulated. Everybody feels it. Everybody benefits from it. You get to decide what you do with that information, but like it does. It has a ripple out effect for sure.
Yeah. And I think that that's one of the potentials in non-monogamy. And this is not to say that every non-monogamous relationship has this, but I think there is a really amazing potential in non-monogamy for us to build networks of connection where we support the growing capacity for regulation in our nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this is a really, really important piece, whether you're practicing non-monogamy or not, to look at how do I expand the relationship network through which I can experience regulation.
Yes.
Because what that allows us to do is improve our resilience.
Mm-hmm.
We grow more resilience, which means the storms of life that are coming at us, which let's face it, are so many today.
Yeah.
We have climate change, we have wars, we have genocides, we have economic collapse, we have all the things. That's a lot for us to engage with.
Yeah.
And we can co-regulate, not just one-on-one, but as community. We can also co-dysregulate, which is, you know, we all need to be doing this work together. But when we can come into those spaces of community co-regulation, whether that's with intimate partners, whether that's in sex, whether that's not in sex, whether that's with friends, whether that's in spiritual communal spaces or whatever that looks like, we get to increase our capacity for resilience. We get to increase our capacity to connect with ourselves.
Yeah.
We get to increase our ability to show up for what's happening in the here and now, for what's asking to be attended to in the world that we live in. Both our individual personal world and the wider global sphere
absolutely.
Of things.
God damn, this is so interesting. I could keep going and going. Okay, so in summary, everybody, it does not matter to either of us whether or not you want to explore non-monogamy as an actual thing in your life. However, I feel like we're pretty aligned that everyone would probably benefit from asking more of these questions, getting more curious about what feels liberating and what feels oppressive inside of a structure that has been handed to you, and not necessarily to push back against them, but just to be honest with yourself and have more honest conversations with your partner or partners so that there is more regulated, more community, more intimacy, like more of everything everybody wants and needs to thrive. That doing this work, even on that intellectual level of just questioning and like you were saying about self-partnership, really just shifting how you hold things sometimes is enough to liberate. I freaking love this. Okay, will you tell everybody where they can find you, because you're magical. Everybody go follow Mel, go learn from them, etc. Where can they find you?
Thanks. So yeah, you can find me online. My website is radicalrelationshipcoaching.ca because I am based in Canada. And you can find me on social media on Instagram and Facebook at Radical Relating. And sign up for my mailing list, go follow my socials. I offer workshops on a regular basis. My monogamy detox course, you can also find that directly at monogamydetox.com. And I'll mention that that course is designed specifically for non-monogamy, but it's not limited to non-monogamy. So I have a lot of people come into that course who are like, I just want to challenge my monogamous assumption.
That's perfect. That's exactly perfect after this conversation. Because I was going to say, what would you recommend as a starter resource for someone who's like, well, I've never thought about it and I'm not trying to open my relationship or anything. I just want to learn more.
Yeah. And I mean, I come in from that relationship anarchist perspective with that. And the idea is let's explore a liberatory structure that everyone can understand, that everyone can situate themselves within, so that we can all have more tools in our toolkit for understanding ourselves and our relationships with others. So that's at monogamydetox.com.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much, Mel. It was an absolute pleasure to have you here. Everything you've said is so in alignment, so juicy, so interesting. So I appreciate it. And to everybody listening, thank you so much for being here. And I will catch you next week. Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Nealand, and I want to take a moment to thank you for listening to this episode of the This Is Not About Your Body podcast. I put out new episodes every Tuesday, so be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss it. And if you really enjoyed it, please go ahead and leave me a review. Also, if you're looking for more information about body neutrality or you want to work with me, you can find me at my website, jessenealand.com. Or you can just purchase my book, Body Neutral, A Revolutionary Guide to Overcoming Body Image Issues, wherever you buy books, ebooks, or audiobooks. We can also connect on Instagram or TikTok. My handle is Jesse Nealand. And because I make this podcast available for free and without any sponsors or ads, you can also feel free to show your support using the Patreon link in the show notes. And know that your support, if you decide to participate, is always very much appreciated. Lastly, thank you to my brother, Jason Nealand, for creating the music that plays at the beginning of the show. And thank you for listening, learning, and moving toward personal and collective body liberation.